Okay, the next case is number 14-1001, Pierre Bearing Company, Changshan against the United States.
May it please the Court. In the underlying proceeding, in its initial set of questionnaires, the Department requested that CPB provide its U.S. sales data and define two types of U.S. sales, export price sales and constructive export price sales. Pursuant to the Department's definition and consistent with the statute, U.S. sales are typically classified as export price sales when the first sale of subject merchandise is between the foreign producer or exporter and an unaffiliated purchaser. U.S. sales are typically classified as constructed export price sales when the first sale to the unaffiliated U.S. customer is through a U.S. affiliate. In responding to this initial questionnaire response, CPB chose to report its sales as constructed export price sales despite the fact that other information on the record demonstrated that the first sale of subject merchandise was between CPB and an unaffiliated purchaser, and thus fell within the definition.
Is it your view that the first request should have put them on notice they had to keep the data regarding both CEP and EP?
Correct, Your Honor. Not only did it put them on notice, but that first request specifically requested that EP sales data based on the request that they provide U.S. sales and provided the definition of how the U.S. sales should be treated. So from the outset, they should have, if they were to fully comply with the Department's request, they should have provided the sales data between themselves and the unaffiliated purchaser. They, of course, could have chosen to provide that as well as the CEP prices and continued to argue that the sales were appropriately classified as constructed export price, but they knew from the outset that this information was relevant and had been requested by the Department. So as has been discussed, they essentially provided one set of sales data despite the fact that a different set of sales data fell within the purview of the
So if I didn't think that the request on its face was actually a request that caused them to produce EP price data, I didn't read it because I feel like, quite frankly, you're going a little far in your understanding of what that request actually did expressly ask them to do. But nonetheless, and I don't understand this area of the law very well, so if I say something wrong, correct me. Is it true that both EP or CEP could reasonably use to calculate U.S. import price in various circumstances?
Correct, Your Honor. Those are two different classifications depending on the course of sales that are present in the review.
So is it your belief that whenever an administrative proceeding is ongoing that is going to require an analysis of U.S. import price, that the importer ought to be required to maintain its data on both EP and CEP?
Correct, Your Honor. This case presents presumably a somewhat uncommon situation because of the different sales steps. Every case may not give rise to a situation where there would be export price and constructed export price sales, if that makes sense. But certainly in a situation where it is unclear and there were these multiple steps, a respondent should maintain both sets of sales data to ensure that they would be able to fully comply with any requests.
So to be clear, not every administrative review, if there was a simple one that didn't have all these sales steps, would necessarily require a rule that all CEP and EP data have to be maintained. But in this case, given the complexity and the uncertainty as to the best way to arrive at U.S. import price, clearly requires that.
To be clear, the obligation to not maintain both sets would arise when both sets just simply didn't exist. If, for example, there was no downstream sales, it was simply from the foreign producer to the unaffiliated purchaser, nothing else was at issue, there were no subsequent sales after that, and thus there would only be that one set of sales data, and thus there would be no CEP sales to maintain, if that's clear. So in addition to this initial request, it was then raised by Timken during the proceeding, the absence of this information from the record, and Timken advocated that these sales should properly be classified as export price sales. Matt Jensen raised this in comments to the Commerce Department, and then again raised it in its case brief to the administrator during the administrative proceeding. Both of these submissions were made prior to CPZ's sale to SKF, and thus when CPZ still had control over this information. Then moving forward, Commerce ultimately agreed with Timken that the sales were properly classified as export price sales, and CPZ initiated litigation with the issue of the sales data and the proper classification of its sales at the center of that litigation. Under this circumstance, where from the outset U.S. sales were requested, this type of information is at the center of any anti-dumping duty proceeding, and specific issues have been raised about the reporting and about this data, Commerce's application of adverse facts available based on CPZ's failure to maintain this information is reasonable and otherwise in accordance with law. It's also consistent with this court's case law on this issue. In Nickel and Steel, this court reviewed the issue of the application of adverse facts available and noted that two showings must be made in order for AFA to be applied. First, a reasonable and responsible respondent must be aware that the information at issue is the type of information that should be maintained. And second, the respondent must be shown to have failed to cooperate to the best of its ability by failing to either maintain this information or in failing to exert its maximum effort to obtain it. Both of these showings are present here. As was discussed, this information is specifically the type of information that the department relies on during the proceeding, so the respondent was aware that this information was relevant.
And did Timken twice actually tell Commerce that they ought to be requesting EP data and that that's the data that ought to be used to come up with U.S. import price so that the other side was on notice?
Exactly, Your Honor. Timken raised this issue twice, and again, both of these submissions were filed prior to CPZ's sale to SKF.
Right. Okay.
At what point in the proceedings does the requirement to maintain the records attach?
The obligation to maintain the information, this court in Nippon Steel indicated that the respondent has an obligation to maintain any information that they reasonably anticipate Commerce might request. So certainly a respondent that's under an order, they won't know whether they're going to be participating in an administrative proceeding until requests have been submitted and a review has been initiated. So, you know, building up to that time, this information should be maintained in case a review moves forward. And Commerce is able to request information from interested parties at any point during the proceeding. So throughout the life of an administrative review, there is a chance that information could be requested, and thus a respondent has an obligation to maintain this information in case it's requested. Now here we have a situation where there was litigation initiated, and so because these issues were essentially still live and Commerce had the ability on remand to reopen the record, that obligation continues throughout the life of the judicial review, particularly the situation here where the information at issue is at the center, this information is at the center of the litigation. Now, in addition to Nippon Steel, this court also affirmed Commerce's application of adverse facts available based on the respondent's failure to provide information during a remand, but it was requested during a remand proceeding in Ta Chen. Now, in affirming Commerce's application of AFA, the court noted that it was reasonable that Commerce should have expected that the respondent should have maintained its information, and that by failing to maintain the information, the respondent bore the risk that Commerce would request it.
In Ta Chen, the facts were flipped, right? Ta Chen, they didn't keep EP, but they kept CEP here, and in Ta Chen, it was the other way around. Right?
You're correct, Your Honor. In Ta Chen, the respondent there, Ta Chen, had submitted export price sales, and Commerce ultimately determined that constructed export price sales were the appropriate basis. And I would also note that the basis
of... Should I read those cases for the proposition that when both of them are potentially at issue, the contractor has an obligation to maintain evidence with regard to both?
Yes, Your Honor. In both that case and here, there was this question about what the appropriate sales were. And again, you know, we're talking about the information at the very heart of a dumping determination, the U.S. sales. That information is clearly relevant to the Commerce Department, and particularly in a situation like this and in Tachin, where there could be arguments on either side.
Well, can I ask a question? And I understand that they did not argue this exactly the way I'm about to say it, but why doesn't Tachin potentially help them in that Tachin said in a scenario like this, it's actually CEP that you ought to be focusing on, not EP. That's the better one to use. And so why wouldn't that provide, and I realize they did not make this argument, but why wouldn't that provide for them an argument that, well, we kept CEP because after Tachin, we understood that was what was to be at issue in a scenario like this?
Your Honor, the facts in Tachin were slightly different, and so it's not exactly in that respect on all fours with our case. The issue in Tachin was whether or not a particular party's son was affiliated with Tachin. Now, Tachin had initially reported its sales as EP sales under its belief that there was no affiliation between it and Sun. However, Commerce the statute had changed regarding affiliation, and so Commerce now raise questions about, well, maybe Tachin and Sun are affiliated, and if they are affiliated, then the appropriate sale is CEP sales. And I don't believe the respondent in Tachin argued that if it was in fact affiliated with Sun, that CEP sales weren't appropriate. The issue there was whether or not there was affiliation. Here we don't have an issue. Here we have a sale.
I'm not going to pretend to understand everything you just said, but what I did get out of it is the choice between EP and CEP is very fact-specific in a given case. Is that a fair statement?
Yes.
Okay.
And unless there's any questions at this point, I would like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Bell. Ms. Clea.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Diana Quire, representing plaintiffs, I believe, Peter Billion Company. I would like to start by saying that the lower court was not in error when it demanded the Commerce Department determination to apply adverse facts available on the basis of a respondent's inability to provide certain price information on remand for the first time, even though Commerce never requested that information during the proceeding, nor did it give an indication to the respondent that the information would be necessary to calculate the margin. And the issue with Timken's argument is that it suggests that the respondent's inability to provide certain information in itself is the basis for the application of adverse facts available. And that is a very broad interpretation of Section 1677E, because what the statute requires are two requirements, two independent findings. So the first finding under subpart A of 1677E is that the Commerce determined that information is unavailable or that the party fails to provide the information. And the second finding that is separate and also necessary is that there was a lack of cooperation. And in the language of the statute, Commerce must show that the party failed to cooperate to the best of its ability to comply with a request for information. Now here, the mere inability of CPZ to provide this data on remand was the basis for both Commerce's decision to apply, to resort to facts available and not use the data on the record, and to apply an adverse inference. This is a very broad interpretation of the statute that practically makes it impossible for respondents to avoid the application of adverse facts available. Because on the one hand, Timken interprets the statute to mean that there is an open-ended obligation on duties on parties, open-ended duty on parties, excuse me, to maintain records of information that was never requested. On the off chance that this may be necessary sometime in the future, which could be years later after the administrative proceeding ended.
Well, but Timken is not making that argument for the first time in this court, because that's what was at issue in Nippon and Tachin also. There were similar facts, and undoubtedly the court in both cases adopted a standard that required maintaining things even before they had been requested. So I feel like your argument, you may have an argument for why you didn't have to maintain this data, but it can't be the distinction of it hadn't yet been requested, because Tachin and Nippon said you can anticipate certain kinds of things being relevant, and if a reasonable, what do they say, reasonable contractor or reasonable importer, there was some language they used, would know that it was going to be relevant and it has to be maintained.
Well, there is a critical distinction between this case and Nippon Steel and Tachan. Just to recount briefly the facts of Nippon Steel and Tachan, in both of these cases, the information was requested by Commerce during the proceeding. In Nippon Steel,
in Tachan, that doesn't seem to be the case. It came after remand. The majority doesn't clearly say the information was first requested, and the dissent points out and points you back to the brief that, in fact, the first request did not contain it. So I guess I'm having trouble understanding that particular. You made it in your brief, and I'm not going to say it's a misrepresentation, because if I read only the majority's view, I would be confused about whether the first request included it or not. But the dissent says quite clearly it did not request it first. So, I mean,
another distinguishing factor with Tachin is that in Tachin, the issue was a question of affiliation. And that was raised by petitioners in Tachin in the first administrative review. It was, Commerce had that argument before it. It did not act upon it. In the second administrative review, again, Tachin reported this information on an export price basis as if there were no affiliation. In the third review, so 3 years later, petitioners again raised that argument. At that point, Commerce sent Tachin a supplemental questionnaire asking questions about this potential affiliation. So if the argument is, it made this adverse decision against Tachin in the preliminary result of that third administrative review. Now, so the distinction between this case and Tachin is that the respondent in Tachin had known that this could be an issue for 3 years prior to the adverse decision that was made by Commerce. In this case, Timken made the comment that, yes, Commerce should actually request EP prices and not CEP prices. In those same comments, Timken also made a variety of other requests. Timken suggested that CPZ should not be entitled to a separate rate. It made other comments regarding the factors of production. Now, Commerce obviously took notes of those comments, but in the preliminary determination, it used the prices as reported by CPZ. At that point, CPZ had no indication that its methodology was being questioned by Commerce, that was not accepted by Commerce. Moreover, after the preliminary determination, Commerce issued a post-preliminary supplemental questionnaire to clear up any factual issues that it still had. In that supplemental questionnaire, it asked CPZ for factors of production information. It didn't ask one single question about affiliation, about the question of export price versus constructed export price. Therefore, and of course, Timken did raise the issue again in its brief, but at that time, the parties had no expectation that Commerce would not accept the CEP data on the record. And more to the point, in the prior reviews of this order in which CPZ had participated, it had always reported prices on a CEP basis because it was selling to the United States market through a U.S. reseller that was affiliated, Pierre Bearing Company. In all of these prior reviews, Commerce accepted the CEP methodology. There was no question that these were not transactions between affiliated parties. So for the first time in this case, at the very last moment, Commerce changed its mind. And the fact that it changed its mind at a very last moment is very obvious from what it decided to do. So instead of asking CPZ to provide information on the record, EP prices, in case it may need it for the final determination, what Commerce did was something completely out of the ordinary. It took two purchase orders that were on the record. It computed a ratio between the price between CPZ and the unaffiliated importer and the price between the importer and peer, and used that ratio to adjust all of the prices in the database. It was a methodology that was completely unauthorized by statute.
Can I ask you, in the final determination, Commerce, for the first time, used EP, right?
Correct.
I got that right? Okay. So by my calculation, that was 4 months and 11 days after CPZ was sold. Is there any evidence in this record that your company made like a good faith attempt to immediately preserve or go to them and preserve EP? Because as of the final determination, you were on notice that EP price was something Commerce was looking at. So at that point, unquestionably, there had to be some onus on you to figure out if the EP data existed. Is there anything in this record about that?
Well, to impose that type of notice would require a sequence of logical steps to happen, which actually happened in this case. So that would mean first that Commerce, that there would be a remand, which CPZ didn't presume would be the case, that there would be a remand, that the record would be reopened to accept new information. That is a rare occurrence on remand, because typically this is the cases are decided based on the information on the record. And most important, CPZ at the time, the ownership had already transferred, but CPZ had already taken steps to preserve the information. It had collected information on its own, but also it had secured an agreement with the new owners of CPZ through the master purchase agreement to have access to the data for the relevant to the dumping reviews if that information was to be requested. It was requested here. CPZ availed itself of this contractual obligation of the new owners and went on to request the data. The fact that the data was not that the new owners could not provide the data to us doesn't erase the fact that CPZ had taken steps to preserve it, to gain access to it, and has taken all the steps a reasonable respondent would have done. So it doesn't that does not nullify the fact that it had cooperated to the best of its ability. More access, a more reasonable respondent than that, I don't know what it could have done more than CPZ had done here.
If you were asked to craft a general rule about when a party such as this falls under an obligation to maintain its information and its records, what would your rule look like?
My rule would be based on what the existing cases suggest, and the existing cases that deal with maintenance of records look at maintenance of records that support questionnaire responses or support verification of questionnaire responses or refer to data that was requested during the administrative review. Again, to impose a duty to maintain records indefinitely of information of any type is quite unreasonable.
But that would be a very large volume of records, would it not, if you're establishing all of the considerations that go into these calculations? So you're saying that any exporter to the United States just can't dispose of any manufacturing records or whatever might be, subsidy records, transportation records, anything that could conceivably be later announced to be relevant, and require any, let's say, bona fide purchaser to do the same with the prior records?
That is the logical conclusion of what Timken's position is, which is if you have such an open-ended obligation to maintain records, it's simply impractical to deal with it because dumping calculations are extremely complex. There are factors of production, especially involving non-market economies as this case is. There are factors of production for a myriad of material inputs that need to be collected to prepare the questionnaire responses. And if we're going to data that was not even used to prepare that questionnaire response, which is here the EP data, the universe is very large. I would simply also note to the court that the database in this case contained more, the sales database, more than 11,000 observations. So for each observation, a company at verification should be, and is required to substantiate each of the, let's say, variables that are on that observation.
Is that in fact the position here, or are you looking only for the transfer price to the initial purchaser in the United States? I mean, is there in fact a basis. Certainly the Court of International Trade thought that Commerce was asking too much.
Yes, Your Honor. CPZ agreed. Commerce was expecting that CPZ would preserve records for information that it did not use to prepare its questionnaire responses.
But nothing was preserved, I gather.
No, there was information preserved. For example, all of the U.S. sales data resided in the United States at Peer Bearing Company, which was owned under the old ownership of CPZ. All of that data was preserved. The question here is that export price data was kept in China, small company in a relatively small town, where at the time of the 2006-2007 transactions, some of this information was kept manually. So the company did preserve records that it thought it was necessary, records that it had. It just couldn't anticipate all of the possible information it would need from China.
But still, I gather nothing was at all was preserved. Is that correct?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
I gather that nothing was preserved.
The company did preserve certain data, and in fact, it was able to provide
CPZ.
Yes,
did preserve.
Yes, data. Did preserve certain data. It just didn't have a complete database of 11,000 observations with EP prices.
How many did it preserve and supply in response to the request?
Oh, I couldn't respond.
I thought it was zero. That was my recollection. It was zero. So I think there's a big difference between it preserved some of 11,000 and it provided zero. So I want to know whether I'm misremembering the facts.
No, it preserved some of the information, some of the underlying documents. It didn't have a complete database. What it did, it went to the current owners of CPZ, to SKF, because it had this ability under the master purchase agreement to ask SKF to generate a database. SKF indicated that it had queried its records and the information was not available, and it offered a series of reasons why that was the case.
Can I ask one more question? Earlier, you said something in response to my question about the sale and was there any obligation to maintain documents, and I thought that you had said that was part of the contract, that you let them know that there was an administrative duty and that they ought to preserve documents as part of the contract. Is that right?
Yeah.
Because I'm looking at the contract and I don't see that anywhere in the contract. The only thing I can find is that you all have the right during normal business hours to come back and look for documents, but I can see nothing that suggests any documents ought to be maintained by virtue of anything.
What the master purchase agreement said, and I'm not reading.
It's at 3072. If that would help you in your mind. I mean, because just saying you can do whatever you want with documents, but if I happen to come back during normal business hours, you have to let me look for them. It's a far cry removed from informing them that they ought to be preserved.
Well, SKF is a company that is well experienced with anti-dumping duty reviews. They would know what is involved in preparing a database and in providing information in response to dumping reviews. And in fact, based on this agreement, CPZ was able to provide complete questionnaire responses to Commerce in two more reviews, in the 2007 and 2008 review and 2008-2009 review. It was the data between affiliated parties, which is the data at issue here. It's prices between CPZ, the unaffiliated importer, and Peer. That information is not typically used by the department. The department does not use prices between affiliates because they're not considered arm's length. So the information that was preserved had to do with the sales data in the United States. It had to do with factors of production data. While the contract is not worded exactly as Your Honor has suggested to do to preserve records, SKS knew what responding to anti-dumping duty requests would entail. And there was an understanding. And in fact, that understanding is confirmed by the fact that it was able to respond in two subsequent reviews and provide full information.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to start with addressing this idea that any obligation to maintain the information at issue here would be some open-ended, broad obligation to maintain all information that ever could possibly be imagined to be asked.
That's not your position.
That's not the situation that we have here. What we have here is information that is at the center of a dumping calculation, which is U.S. sales price, information that questions about it had been raised during the review, so the respondent was well aware that it was an issue, and the fact that Timken raised this during in its case brief and requested that Commerce treat the sales as export price sales for the final determination made it a very real possibility that Commerce could choose to do so. And when the case went to litigation, as I mentioned, you know, these sales were the center of the dispute, the questions raised on litigation, and in fact, in its memorandum in support of its motion for judgment on the agency record that CPZ submitted to the Court of International Trade, they faulted Commerce's application of facts available because Commerce had failed to request this information. They said Commerce can't do this because the information wasn't requested here. So they clearly knew that this information, you know, if the case was to be remanded, that Commerce may come back and say, okay, we couldn't apply it then because we hadn't requested this information, so we're requesting it now.
At what point in the process was that?
This was before the CIT, so this was after the initial briefs that were submitted to the Court of International Trade.
After the first Commerce action that was appealed, because it's like ping pong.
Yes, Your Honor. Correct, Your Honor. So Commerce has issued a final determination okay. in which they classified the sales as export price sales. Then in the very first stages of litigation, which CPZ initiated, in their very first brief to the Court of International Trade, they challenged, and part of what they challenged was Commerce's use of facts available in its final determination, and they said you can't apply facts available here because you never requested this information. So that certainly raised, they certainly were aware that on remand.
And did the sale occur before or after that point in time?
This was after the sale had been made. So the sale was in September of 2008. Which was after the preliminary Commerce's preliminary determination, but before Commerce's final determination. So the respondents here were aware that this information was at the very center of the dispute, and as Judge Moore, you indicated in Ta Chen, we had a similar sequence of questioning where in Ta Chen and here there was this initial questionnaire where Commerce provides its general questions, but the Commerce did not come back and specifically request that information again until the remand proceeding, and in Ta Chen, this court said it's entirely reasonable for Commerce to expect that such information would be maintained here, and that's exactly what happened in our case. On remand, they requested it, and Commerce, it was certainly reasonable for them to expect that the information would be maintained. One final point I would like to make, and this is CPZ's reliance on Commerce's use of constructed export price sales in the prior administrative reviews, in which CPZ has participated. I would just note there that a review of the record in those proceedings does not provide any information that there was this unaffiliated importer transaction in existence, and thus there appears to be a distinction in fact between the prior proceedings and this proceeding, which would support Commerce's different treatment in the prior proceedings compared to this present proceeding. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you both.
I wanted to say, you guys were both awesome. You were extremely well prepared and fabulous. You helped me understand very complicated concepts, and thank you for doing such a great job.
Okay. Thank you all. The case is taken under submission.